A note to listeners, this episode contains descriptions of racial violence. Please take care while listening. May 1940, the Dutch port of Emmerden, just after dawn. The German invasion of the Netherlands is underway. Off in the distance, anti-aircraft guns let rip as bombers drone overhead. A Chevy car through the streets, heading for the main road leading to Amsterdam. As the driver focuses on the road, in the back seat, Jan Smit feels the revolver in his hand. Smit's a Dutch diamond merchant, and he's never held a gun before. It's heavier than he imagined. He grins and suddenly points it at the British spy sitting next to him. The spy frowns.
For pity's sake, Jan, stop that.
Smit bursts out laughing, his round body wobbling beneath his silk shirt.
You're supposed to stick your hands up.
Jan, I gave you the gun for protection. It's not a toy. You must stay focused. We get the diamonds and we get out, nothing more. Holland will fall to Germany within the next day or two, and our boat out of here tonight won't wait.
Smit turns to look out of the window. As the flat countryside whizzes past, he sees bombed-out buildings, distant explosions, and the dead, crumpled bodies of German parachutists. The seriousness of this top-secret mission is starting to dawn on him. They're headed to the Diamond Boers, the center of Amsterdam's centuries-old diamond trade. Their mission is to collect its stockpiles of industrial-grade diamonds. Industrial diamonds are now the bedrock of mass production. Diamonds are the only material hard enough to precisely cut the latest steel alloys. And without those alloys, you can't make tanks, bombers, or submarines. So keeping Amsterdam's diamonds out of Nazi hands is vital, and Smit's the well-connected guy who can get the city's diamond traders to part with their stock. By mid-afternoon, Smit's in the Diamond Boers. He watches as traders fill his canvas duffel bag with diamonds. Minute by minute, the once distant gunfire edges closer and closer. Smit watches a man named Isaac approach. He's a diamond polisher, and he's aged a lot since Smit saw him last. Isaac's bony fingers clutch a leather briefcase.
Jan, my wife, with her cough, she won't survive a labor camp. Please, take her to England with you.
Smit looks away. Isaac understands his old business acquaintance won't be able to help. Quietly, he opens his briefcase and removes several packets of diamonds.
Here, take them to England. Keep them out of Germany's hands.
He turns to go, but Smit stops him.
Isaac, wait. I'll give you a receipt. I've known you 30 years, Jan. Don't be silly. Isaac, stay in touch.
Isaac smiles as he fights back tears.
Yes, I shall ring you from the labor camp. Ha ha. Sorry, but what can one do in times like these but joke?
That evening, as Germans close in on Emmerden, Smith and the spy climb back onto the British Royal Navy destroyer that dropped them off that morning. Smith watches the burning port shrink from view and clings tightly to the duffel bag filled with millions of dollars of diamonds he's just snatched from Hitler's grasp. On returning to Britain, Smit delivers the bag to De Beer's London office to be locked away inside its underground vault for the rest of the war. But the wartime struggle for industrial diamonds is only beginning, and soon it will pit America against De Beer's in a showdown for diamond supremacy. Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/business.
From Wondery, I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. On the last episode, Ernest Oppenheimer seized control of De Beers and paid ad agency N.W. Ayer to convince America that every marriage proposal needs a diamond ring. But now Hitler's armies are on the march, and everyone's clamoring for industrial diamonds. This is Episode 3, Diamond Dogfight. November 1940, the White House. Assistant Attorney General Thurman Arnold lights his pipe and looks at the men around the table. They're the men President Roosevelt's tasked with stockpiling supplies in case America joins the war in Europe and Asia. But Arnold's got no idea why they've dragged him into this meeting.
Hey, can we just skip to the part where you tell me why the hell I'm here?
The official gives Arnold a dirty look.
Fine. We're having trouble stockpiling diamonds.
Diamonds?
Yes. Industrial diamonds. We need them to make armaments. If we run out before our enemies, our capability to build everything from bullets to airplanes will be compromised.
Okay, but what do you need from me?
There's only one supplier, the De Beers cartel in London. They'll sell us the diamonds, but in return, they want immunity from prosecution under our antitrust laws so they can operate on U.S. soil.
Arnold removes his tobacco pipe.
No. Absolutely not. I built my name taking on monopolies and cartels, and you said they're in London, right? Then get the Limeys to lean on them.
It's not that easy. The Brits are siding with De Beers. Diamond sales are an important source of dollars to them. London says if we don't give De Beers immunity, our diamond supply could be threatened.
You want me to put Americans at the mercy of a monopoly? I will not do it. Tell De Beers to stick their request where the sun don't shine.
It's a few days later, and in Johannesburg, De Beers' boss Ernest Oppenheimer sits in his office, looking concerned. He absent-mindedly strokes his mustache as he rereads the memo informing him that America will not give his cartel immunity from antitrust laws. He turns to the executive who brought it to him.
How disconcerting. Not even an acknowledgement of our pledge to hold prices at pre-war levels.
Indeed, sir.
Oppenheimer presses his hands together.
Remind me, how big a stockpile do the Americans want?
A year, sir. 6.5 million carats.
That's farcical. They cannot possibly need that much.
Sir, they fear London will fall to the Germans and with it our stockpile there.
Yes, but what happens if we supply that quantity and the war ends suddenly? Then they'll just sell the stockpile, causing prices to collapse and unleashing chaos. I built the syndicate to prevent chaos in this industry, not to enable it.
Indeed, sir.
How should we respond? I offer the Americans 2 months' supply towards their stockpile. Not a carat more.
Battle lines drawn. De Beers and the White House wage war. The U.S. government presses for more diamonds. De Beers digs its heels in. The White House demands that De Beers build a diamond stockpile in Manhattan. De Beers refuses point blank. As Luftwaffe bombers flatten entire British cities, the White House seizes the moment to warn the UK government that the US will stop supplying planes unless De Beers hands over more industrial diamonds. With the stakes rising and America on the verge of joining the war, De Beers gives a little. It agrees to move some of its London diamond hoard to Canada for safekeeping, but the U.S. can only access it if there's a shortage and must pay half the stockpile costs. Reluctantly, the White House agrees. But De Beers' need for control isn't America's only wartime diamond headache. When the war started in 1939, De Beers stopped selling industrial diamonds to Germany, but the Third Reich is still getting diamonds from somewhere. And the Belgian Congo is the only place that could produce enough to satisfy the Axis powers' needs. So America sends undercover agents to the Congo to investigate. May 1944, Leopoldville, capital of the Belgian Congo, present-day Kinshasa. In his hotel room, Agent Titon reads the coded telegram telling him to abort his mission.
Sorry, Washington. The party's already begun.
He puts the telegram into the ashtray on his desk and strikes a match. Then, he watches the telegram burn. Titon came to the Congo a year ago. Now he's got a pretty solid grasp of the diamond smuggling ring that's keeping Hitler in arms. And it runs deep. Senior people in the Congo's diamond mining corporation are involved. And that's, well, tricky. Because that company is majority owned by the Belgian government. The Belgian government that's supposed to be fighting Hitler and is currently in exile in London. The British felt the smuggling was too sensitive to raise with the Belgians without more proof. So Washington told Titon to get proof by buying some diamonds on the black market. Titon never liked this plan. Now, his assistant is missing, probably being beaten until he gives up Titon. The telegram calling off the mission has come too late for them both. Titon lights a cigarette and watches the last remnants of the telegram turn to smoke and ash. A few minutes later, he hears booted footsteps heading towards his room. He takes a final look at the hazy waters of Congo River through his window and opens the door.
Howdy, officers. You're under arrest for being here on false papers.
Titon nods and offers his wrists for the handcuffs. Later that day, he's deported back to the U.S. But the diamond smuggling ring doesn't save the Third Reich. By the end of 1944, the Nazis are running out of diamonds and the currency needed to buy them on the black market. Soon, its war machine starts breaking down, accelerating its defeat. In April 1945, as Berlin falls to the Allied advance, Hitler commits suicide in his bunker. Germany surrenders a few days later, followed by Japan in August. And now that the war is over, GIs are returning home to pick up where they left off by settling down and getting married, which means De Beers can renew its push to convince America that no marriage proposal is complete without a glittering diamond ring. It's 1947, and in her Philadelphia apartment, Frances Garrity looks wearily at the clock on her kitchen wall. It's past 3 a.m. She knocks back the last dregs of coffee in her mug. Garrity is an ad agency copywriter at NW Air, and she's on deadline. At 9, she's got to be at the office with a De Beers campaign ready to go. She rubs her eyes and rereads the last line she just wrote.
Choose a fine stone, and you'll always be proud of it, no matter the size. That works. I think I'm done.
But then she notices something on the ad. A big white space at the bottom. The space where the signature line goes. It's the most important line in the ad, and she's forgotten to write it. Too tired to press on, Garrity seeks divine intervention.
Oh, God. Please, please give me something.
She scribbles a stray thought on a scrap of paper and crashes into bed with her clothes still on. The next morning, Garrity nurses a strong black coffee as her boss checks her work.
Not bad. So. Fine, good. Oh, hang on. Francis, where's the signature line? I don't see it.
Oh, I have it here. Garrity gets out the crumpled scrap of paper she wrote on before falling asleep. A diamond is forever.
That's it?
Yeah. I'm not sold on it either. Do you want me to think of something else?
No time. I'm leaving to see De Beers, South Africa within the hour. This will have to do. But if they don't like it, then you will be trying again.
But De Beers does like it. A lot. The company embraces A Diamond is Forever as its slogan. Backed by millions of dollars worth of ads, Garrity's words engrave into American minds the idea that diamonds equal romance. In 1939, only 10% of U.S. brides received diamond engagement rings. By 1950, it's 50%. Soon, it'll be 80%. But while the diamond cartel spreads a message of love in America, its country of origin has another message. A message of hate. You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One at zoho.one. That's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind. November 1952, the railroad station, Kimberley, South Africa. Dr. Arthur Latella adjusts his bow tie and turns to his fellow activists from Number 2 location. Number 2 is one of the Diamond City's impoverished townships, built as a compound for De Beers' black miners. Latella looks at his seven comrades, eyes full of determination.
To defiance!
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 As one, they punch the air with a thumbs up. This is the Salute of the Defiance campaign, a national series of protests against South Africa's new white supremacist regime, apartheid. Now, these eight are making their stand by sitting on a bench. Whites stop and stare as the protesters sit on the bench and start singing.
There must be justice in our land.
The police arrive fast.
Juan approaches, face twisted into a snarl, baton in hand.
This bench is for whites only. Get off!
Latella folds his arms.
No. We defy apartheid. We defy those who make us slaves in our own country. We defy those who tell us where we can live, where we can go, who we can love, and even where we can sit.
The police respond by striking them with batons and then arresting them. The next day, the arrests ignite the pent-up fury of the number two township. Hundreds take to the township streets, giving the defiant salute. They smash in the beer hall's windows with stones, torch the police station, and destroy the passbooks non-whites must use to move around the city. Then, they surge uphill toward the gas depot. At the top, the police are waiting with rifles and submachine guns. The police raise their weapons and fire. Protesters crumple to the ground. Men, women, and children flee for their lives. Wounded people writhe in pain as they bleed onto the unpaved streets. At a bus stop, the bodies of a woman and her baby lie next to a bag of spilled groceries. The uprising ends with 13 dead, 78 wounded, and dozens arrested. The Diamond City laid the foundations for apartheid with its compounds for black workers. Now, it points once again to the nation's future. A future where South Africa's white government seeks to preserve its racist system with lethal force. It's 1953, and in De Beers' London headquarters, Harry Winston is about to perform a ritual. A ritual he and the rest of the world's top diamond dealers must perform every fifth Monday. Ernest Oppenheimer's diamond-buying ritual, The Sight. Winston sits alone in a north-facing room. Before him, on a mahogany table, is a brown cardboard box, and inside is his latest allocation of rough diamonds from the De Beers cartel. He knows how this goes. He examines the gemstones in the box. Then, he buys the box without complaint, even if he thinks the diamonds are not worth the price tag. And this time, the diamonds definitely aren't. A De Beers executive in a Savile Row suit quietly enters the room and looks at Winston's short, round frame.
Have you reached a decision, Harry?
Winston feels his blood boiling. He resents this pretense and the way the cartel's men hide their ice-cold hearts behind a veil of politeness. Winston glares at the box. His company handles one in every four diamond engagement rings sold in America. Why should he have to play these games? He remembers hearing that Portuguese Angola wants out of the cartel. Maybe he could do a deal. With Angola's diamonds behind him, he'd no longer be shackled to De Beers. He'd be free. He looks up.
Yeah, I've made a decision. I'm not buying these trinkets.
Winston dramatically pushes the box aside. The De Beers man shows no emotion.
Is that your decision, Harry?
Winston pauses. He's about to declare war on the diamond cartel, a cartel even the White House couldn't break. But he's not about to back down.
Yes, that's my decision. Very well, Harry. I will escort you out.
Fall, 1953, Lisbon, Portugal. Winston sits in his hotel room and drops a tablet of saccharin into his lunchtime coffee. He's waiting on a call from the office of Portuguese dictator Antonio Salazar, inviting him in to discuss buying Angola's diamonds. Winston's feeling confident. The Salazar regime seems very keen.
Harry Winston?
Hello, Harry. It's Ernest Oppenheimer.
Winston's jaw drops. How does Oppenheimer know he's in Lisbon? He told his staff to keep this trip on the down low.
Oh, hello, Ernest. What can I do for you?
I hear you are persisting in your efforts to interfere with our negotiations over Angola's diamonds. Well, you should be aware that by continuing, you will forfeit your invitations to future sites. However, if you stop now, your allocations at sites may improve.
May improve?
Yes. I believe that's what I said.
No guarantees?
Harry, a single sales channel is in all our interests. As you know from your own experience, everyone in the syndicate profits, even if they sometimes dream of more. I shall leave you to think it over.
Winston knows that was his final warning. He sips his coffee and wonders what to do. Then, the phone rings again.
Harry Winston?
This is the Portuguese Foreign Ministry. Your meeting this afternoon is canceled and will not be rearranged. You have 48 hours to leave Portugal.
Winston stares at the phone in disbelief. He knows in his gut this is no coincidence. De Beers has just persuaded the Portuguese to leave him high and dry. Now, he knows there's only one way to save his business. He must crawl back to Oppenheimer and beg for forgiveness. But soon, it'll be a different Oppenheimer he'll need to bow to. The 74-year-old Ernest Oppenheimer is handing over his role to his son, Harry. As Harry Oppenheimer steps up, the empire his father built seems as strong as the gemstone it sells. It's proved impervious to war, the White House, and renegade diamond dealers. But deep in the remote frozen emptiness of Siberia, there will soon be a discovery that could change everything. On the next episode, a spy master goes hunting diamond smugglers, communists threaten the cartel, and De Beers targets Japan.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Wondery, this is episode 3 of Diamond Wars. A quick note about recreations you've been hearing. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said. Those scenes are dramatizations, but they're based on historical research. I'm your host, David Brown. Tristan Donovan wrote this story. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Edited and produced by Emily Frost. Sound design by Kyle Randall. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez. For Wondery.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Once Upon a Beat.